Dr. Marty Klein has been a licensed marriage and family therapist and certified sex therapist for 34 years. That's 35,000 sessions with men, women, and couples about desire, orgasm, fantasies, communication, pornography, dysfunction, and much more. Dr. Klein is an award-winning author of 7 books, including the groundbreaking Sexual Intelligence, What We Really Want from Sex and How to Get It. He has testified in state, federal, and interterritorial courts about various aspects of sexuality, and recently gave 2 congressional briefings on evidence-based sex education. Each year, Dr. Klein trains psychologists, physicians, and policymakers in sexuality across the U.S. and Asia, 32 countries today. Audiences everywhere describe his talks as thought-provoking, down-to-earth, and entertaining. We think you will, too. Marty's topic on sexual intelligence is a new view in function and satisfaction. Please help me in welcoming to our Commonwealth Club podium today, Dr. Marty Klein.
Thank you, Rosemary. And Eric, thank you too. I know you're busy looking at your email, but thank you too. The number, you know, it takes a village. The number of people it takes to get me on this stage is amazing. And I'm appreciative to all of them. I think we should start at the beginning, you know? That's what we're going to talk about, right? Sexual intelligence, a new view of sexual function and satisfaction. And if you want to access the slides that I'm going to use, you can just go to my website. It's real simple, martyklein.com/slides/commonwealth. It's the most technological thing I've ever done. Now, how many of you remember who Phil Donahue was? Uh-huh. So in 1988, I was on Phil Donahue, and my parents were very impressed. Until, of course, they heard what I had to say. But my parents were very impressed. And my parents are no longer with us. But if my parents were here, they would say that speaking at the Commonwealth Club is a notch above being on Phil Donahue. So I'm just thrilled to death to be here. Now, as Rosemary said, I've been a licensed therapist for 34 years. That's a long time. You do anything for 34 years, you better learn something. And what I want to talk to you about today is about sexuality, and specifically the model of sexuality that most of us have learned without even being aware of it, growing up and living pretty much anywhere in the world, especially in America. And the first question that I want to address is, what do most adults say that they want from sex? And maybe you've been thinking about that for a while. When I ask groups of people, what do you think most adults want from sex? A lot of people say orgasm. Orgasms are perfectly nice. Some of my best friends have them. But they're not everything. What most adults say that they want from sex, adults, we're not talking about horny teenage boys now, right? What most adults say that they want from sex is some combination of pleasure and closeness. And of course, different people mean different things by pleasure, and different people mean different things by closeness. But what most adults say they want from sex is pleasure and closeness. And that does not vary according to the gender of the person. That's what men and women say they want most from sex. Now, what do people focus on during sex? It's not pleasure and closeness necessarily. And it's a good thing because that's how I make a living. Is dealing with people who want one thing from sex and they don't pay attention to it before, during, or after sex. So what is it that people focus on during sex? Well, different people focus on different things, but people focus on how they smell, how they sound, how they look. People focus on trying to prevent somebody from putting their finger where they don't want it. People focus on, I hope I don't climax too quickly. I hope I don't climax too slowly. People focus on, you know, my back is killing me. I have to tell you, when I was first being trained back in the 70s, It's before the internet was invented. We all learned about the sexual parts of the body, you know, the mouth and the nipples and the anus and all that. Now that I'm 65 years old, if you ask me about the sexual parts of the body, the lower back, the knees, the hips, the neck, right? You too, right? Yeah. So people focus on a lot of stuff that has nothing to do with pleasure and closeness during sex. And that helps account for a lot of the problems that people have. People are trying to push away the emotions that they happen to have. People are trying to function the right way. People are trying to have normal thoughts. People are trying to get their partner to do what they want their partner to do without actually telling them what they want them to do. You know, trying to turn their body in a way that the other person has to touch them in a certain place. And people are attempting to ignore thoughts that are a little disturbing for them. And did I mention lower back pain? So that's the kind of things that people are focused on during sex. And so it's no wonder that people have difficulty enjoying sex. They're paying attention to the wrong things. So people are always trying to convince me that sex is complicated. People say, oh, Marty, you know, you're relaxed about sex and you can talk about it. And I don't know what planet you're from, they say to me, but here on Earth, talking about sex is very complicated. Really? So what can make sex complicated? Well, if people feel guilty, of course, that's going to make things complicated, right? People feeling ashamed or embarrassed, that will make sex complicated. People not feeling close to the person that they're being sexual with, that makes sex complicated. People being afraid of getting pregnant when they don't want to get pregnant. People being afraid of not getting pregnant when they do want to get pregnant, that makes sex complicated. People who have difficulty not getting distracted by stuff. You know, people are always telling me that, you know, the barking dog distracted me. The barking dog distracted me, or the kids playing Monopoly in the next room distracted me. Do kids still play Monopoly? That's a shame that kids don't play Monopoly anymore. Memo to self, get kids off cell phones, get them playing Monopoly. And of course, physical pain makes sex complicated. And when people talk about painful sex, I think the assumption is that they're generally talking about vaginal pain. And that's particularly true for menopausal women and for women in general. Intercourse can be painful. But, you know, sex can be painful in a lot of ways. Did I mention the lower back? Sex can be painful if you have herpes and you have an active outbreak. Sex can be painful if you're not using enough lubrication. Sex can be painful if you've been masturbating real vigorously and you have a little irritation someplace. So a lot of things can make sex complicated. Sometimes hiding who we really are from our partner, not letting them know about us, and trying real hard not to reveal who we are sexually, that makes sex complicated as well. So there's a lot of things that make sex complicated. And when sex is complicated, it's harder to enjoy. You know, I see 20 patients a week, and sometimes somebody leaves my office, and I think, you know, it's people like you who give sex a bad name. So when we think about sex being complicated, when we think about sex not being enjoyable, what's the best way to address that? People go to their physician. I speak to doctors all over the country every year. A lot of people, the first person, the first professional they speak with about their sexual difficulties is a physician. A lot of people, the first person they speak with about their sexual difficulties is a clergy person. A lot of people, the first person they speak with about their sexual difficulties is Oprah. So sex therapy is usually not the first person that people talk to. We are way down on the food chain. And when people speak to physicians who are able to prescribe the magic blue tablet, when people speak to the clergy who have a direct pipeline to the truth about sex, right? When people listen to Oprah, who apparently has the answer to every question in human history, the answers to people's questions about sex, when they speak with their physician or their clergy person or Oprah or their sister-in-law, may not be so helpful. And that's because a lot of people, they think to make sex better, you need better erections. A lot of people think to make sex better, you need better orgasms or more reliable orgasms. A lot of people think to make sex better, you need that lubrication to be gushing, like Niagara Falls. Turns out that erections and orgasms and lubrication, as nice as they are, they're not such a good predictor of people's sexual enjoyment. They're nice things to have, but they're not such a good predictor of people's sexual enjoyment. So what could be a better approach to sexual difficulties? The better approach is changing our relationship to sexuality, changing the feelings that we have about our bodies, changing the ideas that we have about what's normal sex, what's not normal sex, changing the ideas that we have about our own sexuality, our partner's sexuality, sexuality in general. That turns out to be the key to making sex easier and more comfortable and more enjoyable and more satisfying and something that people are actually going to want to do more than once or twice a year. Changing our relation to sexuality. So let's talk about how you might do that. A lot of people think that sex has inherent meaning and that we're stuck with those inherent meanings. For example, a lot of people think that in a couple, if one person doesn't have a lot of sexual desire for the other person, that means they don't love them. They think that's like built in to desire. If you love someone, if you truly love someone, of course you're going to desire them. And a lot of people think, for example, that erection, of course you're going to get an erection if you're a real man, and that if you don't get an erection, it means that you're not sufficiently manly. These are two examples of meanings that people give to sexual experiences that are completely constructed. They're constructed. These are ideas that we make up about sex, and then we think we know something about sex. Turns out that these two particular things, not necessarily true. Lots of people love their partner and don't desire them sexually. The technical word for that is marriage, right? So, no, we all have had experiences of loving someone and not necessarily having as much desire for them as we wanted, or not having as much desire for them as they have for us. And then people get to decide what that's all about. So couples come into my office, and one of the complaints is, and again, the genders on this really don't matter. Could be male, female. With this complaint, it doesn't matter. The couple comes in and one of them says, and you don't want sex with me very much, and that proves that you don't love me. And the other person says, yes, I love you. And the other person says, no, you don't. And the other person says, yes, I do. And this person says, no, you don't. And you know, they're paying me by the minute, so I got no complaints with this. So instead of a conversation about sex, this couple is having a conversation about, you don't love me, yes I do, no you don't, yes I do, no you don't. It's not a conversation about sex anymore. It's about the meaning that people give to sex. And so it turns out that people like to assign meanings to every aspect of sex. But we pretend that we're not the ones who are giving sex the meaning. We pretend that the meaning is in the sex. Like, erection means manliness. Well, that's just a funny idea that some of us have. But people and couples are telling stories about sex to each other and themselves all the time. So I spend a lot of my time listening to the stories that people tell about what sex means. What does it mean if you flirt? What does it mean if you can't get an erection? What does it mean if your butt is bigger than it used to be? What does it mean? Now, let me say a word about breasts for a second, since we're talking about butts, right? You know, a lot of women are concerned, a lot of middle-aged women are concerned. And what I say is that as women age, breasts do not sag, they relax. But I'm interrupting myself. So as a therapist, I'm always listening to stories about what sex means. What does it mean that your breasts are no longer around your neck, now they're around your waist? What does that mean? And here, when I think of examples of how people give sex meaning, here's a real common story. Well, you know, when it comes to sex, men will always disappoint you. Or when it comes to sex, women will always disappoint you. Or sex is a waste of time. That's a story that some people tell. Or I'm a sex addict. That's a story that some people tell. Some people tell the story that sex should be spontaneous and natural. Couples come into my office, and one of them will say, let's make a date for sex, and the other one will say, oh, that's so unromantic, I don't want to make a date for sex, I want sex to be spontaneous. And I say, well, how about after the session if we all go bowling together? And I've never had a patient say, yes, let's do that. Every single patient I've ever seen says, oh, I can't go bowling after the session, I have other plans. And what's true in modern life is that we always have other plans. Nobody does anything spontaneously anymore. The most spontaneous thing that you do is deciding what to have for dinner when you go out to a nice restaurant. And even then, a lot of us on our way to the restaurant, we're thinking, ooh, I can't wait, they have such great salmon in this place. Ooh, I can't wait, I can't wait. So that's not spontaneous either. Sex is spontaneous if you're living a lifestyle where you have no plans. The last time I was in that position, I was 17 and a half years old. Most people, at least if you're employed or if you're gainfully retired, most people have plans. And so if they want to make sure they have sex periodically, they have to make a date. If you all didn't have your cell phones turned off, I would say make yourself a reminder to make a date to have sex with somebody. But you all have your phones turned off. So these are the kinds of stories that people tell themselves and each other. I'm very sympathetic about people who have been sexually exploited as children. That's a terrible, terrible thing for an adult to wrestle with. But some people tell the story, I was molested when I was a child, but I'm okay now. Some people tell the story, I was molested as a child, and therefore I can't possibly be expected to have good sex as an adult. So those are two different stories that two different people tell about the same incident. So we're always telling ourselves stories about men, about women, about sex, about love, about romance, about intimacy. And if you read too many women's magazines, that influences your stories. If you read too many romance novels, that influences your story. If you're following Angelina Jolie's life too closely, that influences your story. But everybody's got stories about men and women and sex. Some people have a story that sex can be divided into, well, these kinds of sex are dignified and these kinds of sex are not dignified. Or these kinds of sex are okay for somebody my age, but these kinds of sex, oh no, I'm way too old for that stuff. And these are just stories that we attach to sex. Couples tell these stories as well. It's not just individuals. We're not eligible for sex. We're not those kind of people. Our chance for sex is over, you know, now that we're in our 50s or 80s or whatever it is. Some couples tell the story that, now that we have grandchildren, we just don't have the time for sex. And that's okay with me. If you don't want to have sex, that's fine. But if you want to have sex and you have grandchildren, you have to figure out how are you going to do that? And to blame it on the grandchildren, just not fair. Just not fair. Now, another story that people tell themselves or each other is about erectile dysfunction. ED, erectile dysfunction. I've been in practice since 1980, and in 1980, erectile dysfunction hadn't been invented yet. It was called impotence, which is a very ugly word when you're applying it to a perfectly innocent penis, you know? So we went from, we said, well, you know, impotence is really not such a good word. You know, how about erectile dysfunction? That's a drug company term, you know? And I don't like that term either. When I hear the word dysfunction, my testicles just shrivel right up. So I'm not big on erectile dysfunction, but that's the word, that's the phrase that people are using now. And I get a lot of people coming into the office and they want to talk to me about their erectile dysfunction. And not all of them are 63 years old. You know, I get a lot of guys in their 20s coming in and they want to talk about their erectile dysfunction. And I say, let's not call it erectile dysfunction. Let's not call it ED. And my patients generally, they say, fine, what do you want to call it? I say, well, why don't we call it what it actually is, which is you don't get it up when you want to. That's what it is. And the most important part of that definition is not the you don't get it up part, it's the when you want to part. That's the part that causes people difficulty. So erectile dysfunction, you should pardon the expression, is not necessarily the best way to describe reality. What are some of the circumstances in which a guy does not get an erection that aren't necessarily erectile dysfunction? Well, if he's drunk, you know, you don't get erections when you're drunk. That doesn't mean that you have an erection problem. If a guy feels anxious or if a guy feels guilty, I mean, it seems logical, doesn't it, that if a guy is anxious or guilty that he might have erection difficulties? Some of my patients, they just don't get that idea. I think they're mostly engineers, right? But a lot of my patients, they don't get the idea that your emotions should actually affect whether or not you get erections. So I say, well, let's take a simple example. Let's say that you were making love with a woman and you were having a nice time, and all of a sudden you heard her say the words that no man ever wants to hear in the middle of sex, which is, oh my God, I think I hear my husband coming. What? So I say to these guys, if you were in that situation, if you were making love with a woman and having a perfectly nice time and all of a sudden she said, oh my God, I think I hear my husband coming, what do you think would happen to your penis? And everybody gets that. Everybody says, oh, it would go like this. You know, I would lose my erection immediately. I say, yes, that's right. Partly because your body needs the blood from your penis to propel you out the window, I think. But, you know, most emotionally healthy man in that situation, they would lose their erection immediately. And if that guy in that situation came to see me as a therapist, would I say, yes, you have erectile dysfunction? No. I would say you seem like a pretty healthy person to me. When you're scared out of your mind, it's hard to keep an erection, isn't it? So what other circumstances besides being drunk or scared out of your mind or feeling guilty, what other circumstances don't necessarily mean that you have erectile dysfunction when you don't have an erection when you want it? So feeling pressured or being afraid of creating a pregnancy that you don't want to, that's a common situation. Fear of unwanted pregnancy makes it difficult to keep an erection when you want to. If you don't feel close to the other person, for some men, for a lot of men, that can make it difficult to get or keep an erection. Now, if you think about most men when they're, say, 20 or 21 years old, what is sex like for them the first handful of times that they have sex? They're frequently drunk or stoned. They frequently feel anxious. They frequently feel guilty. They frequently are afraid because they don't know what to do. They frequently feel pressured to deliver the goods. So I get a lot of people coming in their 20s who think they have erectile dysfunction based on a few early experiences. That's pretty easy to resolve. Here's the really sad part. When I get guys coming in their 40s or 50s and they think they have erectile dysfunction, and I ask, well, how long has that been going on? And they say, well, from the beginning. And I say, well, tell me about your early sexual experiences. And they tell me. They say, well, you know, I was drunk and it was the back seat of a car. It was, you know, in my parents' bedroom and I was afraid they were going to come in any minute. And I looked down at my partner and she didn't look like she was so thrilled to be there in the first place. Well, gee, what healthy person could get an erection or keep an erection under those circumstances? So I don't give these guys Viagra. I don't recommend that they get a full urological workup necessarily. I don't think they have ED or erectile dysfunction. What I want to know is, can you create some sexual experiences for yourself that don't have guilt and shame and anxiety and pressure? And fortunately, I can talk to them about, well, how would you actually do that in real life? Once we do that, their whole relationship to their sexuality changes, and they're on the way to having a new lease on life when it comes to sex. Story with a happy ending. So it turns out that changing our stories about sex, changing our stories about what sexual experiences mean or different sexual fantasies mean, turns out that's central to changing people's sexual experience. Unfortunately, that's not what most people do. This is America, where people would much rather take a pill than actually think about what's going on. This is a society where we are told that orgasm is so important when it's not necessarily the best part of sex. And here's a secret that a lot of women don't know. As men age, as men get into their 50s and 60s, having an orgasm is not as easy as it used to be. I'm not going to say, am I right? I'm not going to say that. But I'm telling you, I know this. It's not as easy to have an orgasm. And I get couples coming in, and the complaint is, she says to me, he doesn't have an orgasm when we have sex anymore. That means he doesn't find me attractive. And he says, yes, I do. She says, no, you don't. He says, yes, I do. She says, no. And we're back to, this is not a conversation about sex anymore. And my feeling is, if you don't have an orgasm and you feel okay about it, we don't even have to talk about, oh, 10 million other men have the same experience. No, no, no. If you don't have an orgasm and you feel okay about it, that's it. No problem. No problem. Now, if your partner feels unattractive, let's talk about that. What could each of you do so that you feel more attractive? But that's not necessarily a conversation about sex anymore. So what do people do when they have sexual dissatisfaction? Well, they like to take erection drugs. That's a popular one. A real popular solution when somebody has sexual difficulties is to say to their partner, you need to be sexier. You need to be sexier. Very common approach. Very common approach. A lot of people, they want to get information about new positions. New positions. I got to tell you, there are no new positions. And we've used up all the old ones. There are no new positions. There are new soft drinks on the market, but there are no new positions. So getting a new position, probably not the way to go. People say to me, why don't you write a book with some new positions? I say, well, you know, as long as we have the law of gravity in effect, there's a limit to how many new positions there's going to be, right? I mean, the law of gravity is very bossy about how many positions we're going to have. A lot of people, in order to enjoy sex more, they drink or they take drugs. A lot of people, they say, well, what we need is a romantic getaway. Yeah, 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 that's what we need, a romantic getaway. Let's take $1,200 and let's go up to Napa. You know, without all these romantic getaways, I think Napa would just collapse. But my patients are always going to Napa. They're always going to Napa. You know, if Emeryville could market itself as the place to go to make your sex life better, but I don't hear Emeryville, you know, figuring this out. So people go away for a romantic weekend. Now here's one of the things that I know about romantic weekends, which is that some people, they're very shy about having sex if they think that anybody else can hear them. So they don't want to have sex if there are kids in the house. They don't want to have sex if the next door neighbors are home. They don't want to have sex if like the dog is there. All right. But you tell these people to go away for a romantic getaway. They say, okay, you know, they spend a lot of money, go to Napa. You know, they go to Napa and they check into their hotel, or they go to the Fairmont, they check into their beautiful room. And the very first thing they hear after they check in is they hear the phone ringing in the next room. So somebody starts figuring, oh, that means that the people in the next room are going to be able to hear me if we have sex. So the whole romantic weekend goes down the drain because they can hear the phone in the next room. So romantic getaway doesn't always work out so well. It can be a nice reminder. You know, it can be a nice reminder. This is why we used to like to have sex 20 years ago. But you can't go away for a romantic weekend every week, right? I mean, if you can, you know, go move to Napa, right? So most people, there's a limit to how much value they're going to get sexually from a romantic weekend, plus the pressure. You know, there are people, you know, they're driving back from Napa, and one of them is angry at the other. I spent $1,200, and we didn't even have sex. You know, I could have done that in San Mateo. Didn't have to go to Napa, right? So to resolve sexual difficulties, some people, they want to get a new sex toy, or get into a new kind of, well, let's get into S&M, or let's get into swinging. And there's nothing wrong with all those things if they're approached with the right emotions and with the right kind of communication and all that. But if you take people who are having difficulty talking about sex on sort of a generic level, making the sex more complicated without making the communication better is just asking for trouble. You know, it's like if a person has trouble driving a car, don't put them behind the wheel of an 18-wheel big rig, right? So maybe I should say that again. If a person has trouble driving a car, don't say, well, why don't you go drive a truck? That's what I meant. And you still don't like it. Okay. Well, you know, this is like sex. I mean, some of the things I do you'll like, and some of the things I do, we won't do them again. Like that whole truck thing. Believe me, we won't do that again. So most people with sexual difficulties, they're focused on the sexual content. You know, where you put your hand and where you put your penis and where you put your nose and this and that. Instead of focusing more on the actual sexual experience. So when I talk to couples about sexuality, I don't talk so much about what do you want to do. I talk about how do you want to feel. How do you want to feel? If you want to feel close, for example, if you want to feel emotionally close with your partner, then a position where you're sexual together, where you can see each other's faces, is probably a good idea. If what you want from sex is to feel young, you know, twisting around so it hurts your back, probably not such a good idea. So when people want to know what kind of sex is best or what kind of sexual experiences, what kind of sexual activities they want to do, I say, well, it all depends on how you want to feel. And if you want to feel close, don't worry so much about where the body parts are. Think about where your eyes are and think about where your focus is. So when I was in school, we learned all about sexual function, you know, and you probably have heard this too. It all has to do with your genitalia, right? It all has to do with making these, you know, few square inches of skin down here jump through some hoops, right? And if your penis or your vulva jumps through hoops in the right way, then we say you have good function. Otherwise, we say you're a loser. That's a technical term I learned in graduate school, loser. So a lot of people, they think that the whole point of sex is how you function. It's, do you get an erection when you want an erection? Do you get wet when you want to get wet? Do you climax when you want to climax? To me, that's a very narrow approach to sexuality, because function doesn't necessarily create satisfaction. It's the equivalent of inviting you to my house for dinner and making you the perfect dinner, but the chairs are uncomfortable and the house isn't clean and there's terrible music that you hate blasting from the stereo. Plus, I'm 20 minutes late and I keep you waiting. Doesn't matter how great the dinner is at that point. And if my goal in inviting you over to dinner was to show you appreciation for a favor you had done to me, you wouldn't feel appreciated. So function is a means to an end. It's not an end in itself. In fact, when people are too concerned about, gee, I hope I get it up and I hope I keep it up, or gee, I hope I get wet enough, if you focus on that too much, it will actually undermine your experience of sex. It will make it harder to enjoy sex. Sexual function is not the goal of sex. Creating good sex is not the goal of sex. And orgasm is certainly not the goal of sex. I mean, if sex takes, let's say, 20 or 25 minutes, an orgasm lasts how much? How long does a typical orgasm last? Like an hour, right? No. An orgasm typically lasts about 3, 4, 5, 6 seconds, right? So if sex lasts 20 minutes, an orgasm lasts 6 seconds, and you put all your focus into that 6 seconds, I mean, you're not getting a whole lot of bang for the buck there, right? I'm glad you appreciate that. I mean, you got a 20-minute or a 25-minute experience and you're focused on 6 seconds of it. What about the rest of the time? What about the rest of the time? So enjoying sex is the goal of sex. That is getting your favorite combination of pleasure and closeness. Now, desire is an issue for many people. And couples. And people come to me and they say, I don't have as much desire as I want, or she doesn't have as much desire as I want, or he doesn't have as much desire as he wants, or whatever it is. What are we going to do? What are we going to do about this whole desire question? And my question is always, desire for what? Desire for what? Desire for what? If someone says, I don't have a lot of desire. I say, desire for what? They say, I say, tell me the kind of sex that's available to you. And they say, well, the kind of sex that's available to me is sex with somebody who hasn't taken a shower in a week and keeps calling me by the wrong name, which is why you should always say honey. You know that? If somebody says, the kind of sex that's available to me is with somebody who hasn't showered in a week and calls me the wrong name, I think if you don't have a lot of desire for that, I don't think there's anything wrong with you, right? So when people say they have low desire for sex or their partner has low desire for sex, I need to know a little bit more about the sex. What kind of sex is available? And if somebody doesn't expect to enjoy the sex that they think is available, then if they don't want it, that's not a dysfunction. That's sensible. That's sensible. I mean, that would be like saying, I hear there's going to be a lecture tonight. Why don't you buy a ticket and go? You probably won't like it. Now, how many people do that? How many people do that? Most people say, there's a lecture in town I want to see. I'm looking forward to it. I think I'm going to enjoy it. That makes sense. That makes sense. So it doesn't matter how sexy your partner is, and it doesn't matter how much you love your partner or how much your partner loves you. When it comes to sex, the question is, what kind of experience do you expect to have? If you expect to have a lovely experience, I assume you would have desire. If you expect to have a lovely experience and you don't have desire, that's something that we should talk about. But if you don't expect to have a lovely experience and you don't have desire, I would say the problem is not that you don't have desire. The problem is the kind of sex that you think is available to you. So why don't people enjoy sex? Lots of reasons. You know, people feel performance pressure and people have that same shame and guilt that we keep talking about. People feel like if I don't do it exactly right, my partner is going to get mad at me. Boy, how much of a turnoff is that? If I don't do it exactly right, my partner's going to be mad at me. You know, a lot of people, if that's the situation they're in, they just don't have sex. They say, why should I want to participate in something if I'm just going to get criticized about it? And another reason that a lot of people don't want to have sex is because they've been fighting. They've been arguing. They have conflict with their partner. And the conflict doesn't have to be about sex. The conflict could be about money or kids or in-laws. The argument could be about a lot of different things. And most grown-ups, they typically only have sex on the weekend. You know, most grown-ups don't have sex on a school night. Most grown-ups have sex on the weekend. So all you need is to have one argument on a Thursday. And that pretty much, you know, kills sex for the next 2 or 3 days. After 2 or 3 days, you know, by Sunday night, you're kind of friends again. But oops, it's a school night, right? So then you go another whole week without having sex. And then if, you know, if your mother is visiting or, you know, if your grandkids are visiting, you know, that could knock out that weekend. And nobody has sex on a school night, so it could be another whole week before you have sex. So conflict, somebody feeling angry with each other, somebody feeling unappreciated, somebody feeling like you didn't treat them right, that can kill sex, not just for that moment, not just for the next day or two, but because of logistics, could kill sex for a whole week. And if people aren't enjoying sex, I'm very slow to help them have more of it. So when people come to me and they say, we don't have much sex, I say, well, you know, tell me about the kind of sex that you imagine you'll have if you have more of it. And then when they describe it, I think, I wouldn't want to have sex like that either. I'm with you. You don't want to have much sex? I'm with you. I wouldn't want to have much sex if that's what's available either. And so predictably, why don't people initiate sex? Well, because they don't expect to enjoy it, and because they don't feel attractive, they don't feel desired, because they're tired, because they're tired of being the only one who seems interested in sex in the couple. A lot of people don't initiate because the last three times they had sex, they felt disappointed. And they feel like, well, why should I bother again? So how do you make sex more enjoyable? Well, I want to help people focus on their actual experience rather than on their function. I want to help people talk about their actual experience with each other. And that means using very specific words. You know, everybody knows that communication is the most important part of sex. Well, here's how people communicate about sex on the first day that they come into my office. I'll say, you know, tell me about yourself. And they'll say, well, you know, when we, you know, he has trouble, you know, and then therefore, as a result, it's, you know, so that's our problem. So if that's the way people communicate about sex, communicating more is probably not going to be very helpful. So people need actual words. People need actual words. And a lot of people don't have words. You know, a lot of people, the main word that they have for sex is down there and it. That's not a wide enough vocabulary. It would be like cooking a meal with somebody without having any words for ingredients, without having any words for any verbs for actions, without having any words for implements. You know, so you couldn't, if we were trying to cook a meal together and we couldn't use words like saute or fry or pepper or frying pan, you know, it'd be like, hey, give me some of that, you know, and then let's, and put it into the, you know, and then do that for about 4 or 5 minutes and then you know it. So that wouldn't work out so good. That wouldn't work out so good. So when it comes to sexual function, I think a lot about sense of humor and the ability to relax. I don't think the issue in sex is how to get people more excited. I think the issue in sex is how to get people more relaxed. And if people are relaxed enough, and if they like the person they're having sex with, the excitement is already on its way. And that's what I came here to tell you. So that's all about sexual intelligence. And now we're going to spend a few minutes. Rosemary is going to read me some questions. I'm going to answer questions. You've been a great audience. Thank you very much. I'd be happy to. If you want a copy of these slides and a couple that we actually didn't get to tonight, martyklein.com/slides/commonwealth. I suppose you might even want to know what's the URL of my website. So I should probably tell you. It's www.sexed.org, S-E-X-E-D.org. A fine website, which I have nothing to do with. How are we doing with questions? Do we have at least two questions? Or is everybody just stunned into silence? Good. And if you don't have a question, of course, maybe your friend has a question. Oh, you wouldn't believe the number of friends' questions I answer in a typical week. So I could just talk some more here. Where are we with the question situation? A rabbi, a minister, and a priest walk into a bar, and the bartender says, "What is this, a joke?" What do we have here?
Well, I finally got a few questions.
Okay.
You have.
I'm not running away from you, but I don't want the two microphones to fight with each
absolutely.
Other.
Absolutely.
Because they'll blame me for that. They're always blaming me for things.
I am mostly focusing on, is this a good for my partner, not my own pleasure? That mindset.
Could you start again? Because I didn't hear what you said.
Okay. I am mostly focusing on, is this good for my partner, not my own pleasure?
Big mistake.
That mindset can lead me to feel I am not good enough.
I told you so.
I lose my erection. Solution?
Cut it out. Well, no, this is a great question. This is a great, great question, and it's a perfect example of what I'm talking about. Listen to what the person says. It sounds like a guy. He says, and notice that this question could be asked by a guy who is gay or straight or bi. This question could be asked by a person who's 19 or 99. This is such a common question. And the question is, I'm focusing on something that's not so helpful to me. What should I do? And what the thing that the guy is focusing on almost doesn't matter. Because the answer is, if you're focusing on something that's not helpful, don't do that. You know, when I was growing up, my mother sometimes, there was a spot on her arm. She would press a spot on her arm, and she would say to my father, "It hurts when I do that." And he would say, "Well, don't do that." Right? So a lot of people, a lot of men, a lot of people, what they focus on during sex is, I want to give you the best sex of your life here. Or, I want you to feel like I'm really putting a lot of effort into this whole sex thing. And that really takes away from being present. It's very hard to feel your own body when you're completely focused on somebody else's body. So cut it out.
Which nationalities in the world today have the highest level of sexual intelligence?
Nobody. Next question.
What do you suggest as a treatment for porn addiction, which I define as using porn as a substitute for sex without another person? Is that what you want?
Is that what I want?
I
none of your business what I want. Well, let me answer one part of this question. If somebody feels that what they're doing sexually is actually out of their control, they need to go talk to a professional about that. Now, I have to tell you, different professionals deal with that situation in different ways. The way that I deal with it might be different from the way that from the way that other therapists deal with it. There's a lot of things that people do to avoid being intimate with their partner. Some of them are socially approved, like being the president of the Commonwealth Club. No, seriously, there are ways to avoid being with your partner. Spending way too much time helping the kids with their homework, spending way too much time doing paperwork for the local church, spending way too much time on the internet looking up antique watches. Oh, and by the way, spending a huge amount of time on the internet looking at pornography. So the way that I relate to looking at pornography is the same way that I relate to other things that are like it, which is this person doing this in a way that makes them feel good, or is this person doing this in a way that makes them feel bad? And is this person doing this activity, whatever the activity is, are they doing this activity in a way that helps them accomplish their goals in life, or are they doing it in a way that makes them shake their heads the next morning and say, I can't believe I did that again. I can't believe I spent the whole night looking up antique watches on the internet instead of hanging out with my kids or my wife or my dog or, you know, listening to a podcast of the Commonwealth Club. So I don't view this strictly in sexual terms. What I do is I look at this in terms of, what are your values? What kind of life do you want to have? Does this contribute to your life the way that you're doing it? And if it doesn't, then you need to talk to a professional.
Why do so many men have trouble using condoms?
Why do so many men have trouble using condoms? Presumably you mean during penis-vagina intercourse, right? Like not at lunch or something. I think the traditional answer to this question, the traditional answer is because when you have a condom on your penis, it's harder to feel all those great feelings in your penis. But I think one honest answer to that question that doesn't get talked about enough is, somebody says, I'm afraid I'm going to lose my erection putting the condom on. I'm afraid I'm going to lose my erection while I have the condom on. I'm afraid I'm going to make a mess taking the condom off. So I think we don't talk about that nearly enough. If somebody is afraid of losing their erection putting a condom on, then we need to talk about the details of the activity of putting on a condom. There are a lot of different ways to put on a condom. One is to do it and feel completely separate from the person that you're with. And everything comes to a halt while you fiddle around and the package is slippery and it slips out of your hand, it flies across the room, and now you get out of bed and it's cold out there. So the whole using a condom thing can be complicated in ways that have very little to do with sex. So what I want couples who use condoms to do is that they have eye contact while they're opening the package or putting it on, that they talk to each other while one of them is putting it on. Maybe somebody is kissing somebody or touching somebody while the condom is going on. And that would make a condom part of sex rather than an interruption of sex. And I think that would make condom use for both men and women a lot easier.
I turned my wife down a couple of times when we got married. She is still mad at me. We talked about it, but nothing really changed. She never initiates or wants sex anymore. What can I do?
Let's start with the first part of the question. The first part of the question, I turned her down a couple of times 20 years ago and she's still mad about it. That's not a sex question. There's something else going on there. I don't know what it is. I would have to talk to the people. But when anybody says, X happened 20 years ago and my partner still hasn't gotten over it, I don't even care what the X is. What I want to know is, what's the benefit that you're getting from keeping this wound alive for 20 years? That's really, to me, the interesting part of the question. The fact that at this point in the relationship, she doesn't want to have sex or this or that, she's obviously mad about something. I don't know what it is, but to me, that's not a sex question. That's an, I'm mad, and I'm not going to tell you what it's all about, and you're going to suffer for the rest of your life not being close to me, so ha-ha on you question.
Do you have any suggestions for easy activities or games that encourage relaxed, communicative sex for a couple?
What a nice question. What a nice question. What I would say is don't have sex when you're in a hurry. Don't have sex when you feel self-conscious that you haven't taken a shower in the last 2 hours. Don't have sex in a room that's too hot or too cold. Don't have sex in a place where lots of people might actually see you. Those are the kinds of circumstances that make it difficult for people to relax and enjoy sex with each other. So notice I haven't said, you know, here's what you should do. I'm talking about here's what you shouldn't do, right? And in terms of, you know, what you might want to do, a real easy thing to do is to say, let's give each other a guided tour of our bodies today. You know, that thing in the New York Times travel section, 36 hours in, right? It's always about drinking and eating, which I don't quite understand. I mean, if you're going to go to an interesting place like Heidelberg, who cares where you're going to eat? But, okay, so 36 hours in Heidelberg or 36 hours in Stockholm or whatever it is, fine. 36 minutes with this body, or more realistically, 2 minutes with this body. Let me point out a couple of interesting places. And after I do that, you can point out a couple of interesting places on your body. And when I point out a couple of interesting places on my body, I'll even show you how I like you to touch them. And then you could do it, and then that will be nice for me. And please remember that, and then I'll do the same with you, and I'll remember that. And you don't need the New York Times for that.
One of my friends...
I knew it.
Is into voyeurism. He likes taking pictures of beautiful, young, and sexy legs off women. Does this make him a pervert?
Well, Well, if somebody actually asked me that question, I would say, what do you mean by pervert? And what question are you actually asking? Are you asking the question, is this guy dangerous? Are you asking the question, do I think today it's legs, tomorrow it's going to be God knows what, right? Are you asking the question, do I think that next week it's going to be little kids? Are you asking the question, do I think this person is like a closeted gay person? I mean, I don't know what the question is about. So I don't use categories like pervert, so I wouldn't say yes, he is, or no, he isn't. What I would say is that maybe you have some questions you want to ask him to better understand this activity of his, which can be difficult to understand if you're not into it, and find out what it's like to be him and how he feels while he's doing this.
Romance and closeness are what most women want. Perhaps this is the best foreplay. Has this been a fact that is proven?
First of all, romance and what was the other word?
Romance and closeness.
Right. Romance and closeness is not what women want. It's what some women want, and it's what some people want. I have never noticed a difference between what men, adult men want from sex and what adult women want from sex. It's the same stuff. I want to feel special. I want to feel close. I want to have pleasure. I want to feel desired. I want to feel youthful and graceful. That's what most adults want from sex. Let me reshape the question a little bit. Now, I know that a lot of people want to feel closer to their partner during sex than they do. And in my experience, most people don't talk about that in a very helpful way. A lot of people talk about that with criticism. They'll say, why can't you do such and such? Or they'll say, I hate when you do such and such. Or they'll say, sex? You haven't talked to me all day and now you want sex? What's wrong with you? You know, rather than saying, you know, I would like to have sex with you at some point, and for me, in order to really relax and enjoy sex with you, I would like to feel connected with you. So could we maybe go for a walk around the block? Could we maybe, you know, get on the floor and play, you know, with the dog? Or could we maybe, do some work on my website? Or, you know, whatever makes people feel close, right? Whatever makes people feel close. So I think that sometimes people can be a little bit shy about saying to their partner, you know, sweetheart, I do want to have sex with you under the right circumstances. So let's talk honestly about how to create those circumstances together. Most people will not say, let me get this straight. You want to feel closer to me to have sex? I hate feeling closer to you during sex. Most people don't say that. Most people don't say that. Most people, some people will feel exasperated and say, you mean you still don't feel close? And the answer is no, I still don't feel as close as I want to. I think it would be nice if more people were curious about what their partner wants and what their partner means when they say what they want, rather than assuming.
All right, speaking of the internet, what does the proliferation of internet porn done to all this?
Well, it's made some people rich. Internet porn is a very complicated subject, and no matter what I say, if I don't have 45 minutes, I'm going to sound silly. But I'll say this about internet porn. A lot of couples are talking about internet porn instead of talking about sex. If you're unhappy that your partner is using internet porn, why don't you talk to your partner about your sex life with each other rather than talking about his use of internet porn? It's unusual to find people who are completely sexually satisfied who are in a tizzy because their partner uses internet porn. Most people who are unhappy that their partner uses a lot of internet porn, they're not completely satisfied with their sexual relationship. So what I say about that is talk more about your sexual relationship. You're doing a great job here.
Okay. Any advice for a couple exploring open marriage, been married for 22 years?
Is my tie straight? Good. Well, this is important. Credibility. Exploring open marriage. When couples come to me, there are two different groups of couples who want to talk to me about opening their relationship. One is they don't get along very well and they don't have a very good sex life. And one or both of them has come up with the brilliant idea, let's have an open relationship. The other group of couples who ask me about this, they have a good relationship and they have good communication, and they've come up with the brilliant idea of let's have an open relationship. Open relationship, more than anything, it requires lots and lots of conversation. Lots of conversation. What are you thinking? What are you feeling? What about this thing? What about that thing? Lots of conversation. So what I say to people is, step number one, if you don't like talking about the relationship, open relationship is not for you. And if you don't have good communication skills, if you don't have good relationship skills and communication skills, if you want to get involved in an open relationship, that's just going to make life much more complicated than it already is. So I slow people down about opening their relationship or having other partners or this or that if they don't have the infrastructure. And in this case, the infrastructure is not dams and roads and hospitals. In this case, the infrastructure is the communication system and the time to talk about the relationship and the desire to talk about the relationship. Let me say one more thing. Some people, they're really prejudiced against open relationships, and they say, well, look at this couple over there. They had an open relationship, and then they ended up in divorce. Or look at these couples over here. They have an open relationship, and it's a complete train wreck. And to be fair, what we have to notice is that the overwhelming number, first of all, the main cause of divorce, as we all know, is marriage, right? So the overwhelming number of couples who get divorced, they start out saying, let's be monogamous, right? Most couples who get divorced say that their contract is to be sexually exclusive. So let's not cherry pick the data and say proof that open relationships are a bad thing is look at all the open relationships that end up with divorce. Because the answer to that is, well, look at all the monogamous relationships that end up in divorce. So that's not a fair comparison.
Okay. This is a question that has to do with body imaging. I am a young woman in my 50s who has battled breast cancer and underwent a mastectomy. I do not know how to approach this to tell a man that I have no breasts.
Well, with all sympathy to this person, 50, she's right. She's young. I remember being 50 some many, many years ago. You know, the truth is, if we're talking about adults, I'm assuming that she doesn't want to have sex with a teenage boy or that that's not her preferred market here. You know, if her market is going to be grown-up men, none of us has a perfect body. None of us, with all due respect to the person in the fourth row, none of us has a perfect body. The only question is, which imperfections do you have? Which imperfections do you have? Which imperfections do you have? And missing breasts is a little bit more dramatic than some imperfections, but it's in the same category. This is what happens to bodies as we get older. They get all dinged up. They get scars and they get lumps and bumps and discolorations, and it's just a horrible show. And so, I think the key question here is, does this woman feel like she is, with her mastectomy, without breasts, whatever it is, does she feel that she's in a position to offer a reasonable sexual experience to someone? And if she feels that she is able to offer a reasonable sexual experience to somebody because of who she is, she has nothing to apologize for, and she doesn't need to give anybody a lot of advance warning. You know, it's not like, listen, we've had two dates and I think you like me, but I need you to know right now I don't have breasts. What? Well, I was more focused on your smile, but yeah, sure, whatever. What I would say to that woman is I have a lot of sympathy for her, and that she has nothing to apologize for, and that she needs to focus more on what she brings to the table rather than what she doesn't bring to the table.
We have another question. How do you advise returning veterans with post-traumatic stress dis- disorder and people and paraplegics?
I'll tell you the honest truth. That question is so complicated, I'm not even going to touch it. But what I would say is that sexuality is at the junction of emotional and physical experience. And anybody who's a little dinged up either emotionally or physically needs to pay attention to how they can use sexuality to express themselves in a way that makes them feel good. Other than that, that's a very complicated question.
We have a question. Why did you go into this profession?
Oh, what a boring question.
How boring.
What I'm looking at is this lady in the front row who says, go to closing statements now. That's what I'm looking at. You got question after question after question.
All right.
She's saying, when do we get out of here?
Well, I saved the silliest one for last.
Okay.
Okay. What size is the average penis?
Well, you know, here's a good arena in which averages don't really matter, right? But I get asked all the time, how big should a penis be? I get asked that question all the time. And my answer to that is penises need to be big enough to find in the dark and small enough to get through the doorway. So, you've been really great. Thank you so much.
Thank our audience here, as well as those listening to the recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 106th year of enlightened discussion, is dismissed. Thank you.